The time is now. Volume 7, Episode 136. This is Employment Law Now. I am Mike Schmidt, your host of this podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department here at Cozen O'Connor. Welcome to the Summer 2023 Wrap-Up Part 2. The last episode of this podcast last month, I spent the entire episode talking about the new proposed United States Department of Labor overtime rule. There is nothing new to update or report on that development just yet, as we are still in the public comment period for that proposed overtime exemption rule. We are, however, expecting further word on a final rule from the Department of Labor either sometime in this fourth quarter of 2023 or at the latest in the first quarter of 2024, with, of course, litigation surely to follow. We'll continue to keep you posted on developments there. In the meantime, in this second part of my two-part summer wrap-up series, and I know, you're sitting there saying, Mike, it's the beginning of October. How is this still a summer wrap-up series? Well, folks, it is a summer wrap-up series because I am going to be wrapping up the significant developments that took place toward the end of the summer of 2023 with a little bit of a license to talk about some things that happened into September. For the most part, the weather was warm, and just because the calendar said it was no longer technically summer, I extended this summer wrap-up to September for your benefit. You're welcome. So again, in today's part two, I want to spend some time discussing a few of the more significant developments that occurred this past summer up to and including the end of September. And I'm going to start and end this episode with the EEOC, the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, because that commission, has been active on a couple of fronts. Firstly, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the federal PWFA, as you probably know, became effective on June 27th of 2023, and it generally requires employers with 15 or more employees to make a reasonable accommodation to known limitations related to pregnancy, childhood, or related medical conditions. The Pregnant Workers Fairness Act essentially filled a perceived gap from an EEO perspective, a gap in terms of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, where pregnancy or mere pregnancy conditions were not traditionally considered to rise to the level of a disability that would be covered under the ADA. And on the other hand, Title VII and the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which by its name really only covers discrimination issues. Are you treating pregnant women less favorably than non-pregnant employees? So there was this perceived gap that led to the enactment of the Federal Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. And again, as I've said many a time, and I will say on several occasions in this episode alone, this is a federal statute. Please, please be mindful of your state and local jurisdiction requirements, because they impose discrimination and accommodation requirements in many cases that are greater than those provided in a federal statute like this one. But let's stay with this federal law. The EEOC just issued proposed regulations. They published them on August 11th, 2023, to implement the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. There is now a 60-day comment period, with a little over a week left before that comment period expires, unless it is extended further. As you would expect, the EEOC's proposed regulations are fairly broad and take an expansive view of the act. From a definition standpoint, the coverage, according to the EEOC's proposed regulations, include current pregnancy, past pregnancy, potential pregnancy, lactation, use of birth control, and other pregnancy-related conditions. Notably, the condition does not have to rise to a level of particular severity to trigger the obligations to grant a requested accommodation. Again, keep in mind that this is a gap filler, so it is intended to include situations and conditions that might not rise to the level of a disability under the ADA. Even though the EEOC in its proposed regulations does incorporate the definitions of reasonable accommodation and undue hardship that exist for ADA purposes. The regulations give several examples and offer a wide range of potential accommodations, from breaks or sitting and standing to schedule changes, even telework and remote working opportunities, to parking privileges and light duty and other work-related modifications. It is an important set of proposed regulations. It is an important act. If you are looking for more details on it, go to eeoc.gov, or of course send me an email at mschmidt@cozen.com, and I'm happy to provide you the proposed regulations. Next on our Part 2 Summer 2023 wrap-up, artificial intelligence, AI, continues to be a hot topic. Yes, of course, around the country in states like New York, where regulation and legislation continue to provide certain guardrails around the use of AI for employment-related decisions, but the federal government is getting in on the act, too. In fact, while many of you know and have been seeing what's going on across the ocean internationally, where there has been a lot more progress on AI regulation with some catching up to do from the United States, the federal government, as I said, is trying to get into the act. And this summer, two Democratic senators introduced the No Robot Bosses Act, which is a fairly broad attempt to regulate automated decision systems, not just at the hiring and recruiting stage, but for employment-related decisions that use automated decision systems throughout the employment lifecycle. Some of the provisions in the proposed bill would require certain testing and validation of automated decision systems, a term that itself is broadly defined. It also contains certain training obligations, requirements for certain human oversight in connection with system outputs and work product, as well as certain disclosures of inputs and outputs, and the rights to appeal decisions made by automated decision systems. There are lots of holes and unanswered questions in the proposed bill, and there is no sense at the moment of whether there will be enough support to pass some form of legislation on this topic. Ultimately, as you know, Congress has been knee-deep in spending discussions and government funding for the past few weeks. There is a lot on Congress's plate at the moment. But the point here, the takeaway here, is that AI legislation will continue to be a hot topic both on the state and local levels as well as the federal level in 2023 and 2024. Oh, the NLRB. I've said it before and I'll say it again, can't go an episode or two without some discussion of the National Labor Relations Board. There are some out there, and you know who you are, who were secretly hoping for that October 1st government shutdown, if for no other reason than to slow down, albeit temporarily, a very active roster of federal agencies. Lo and behold, based on an 11th hour weekend activity flurry this past weekend, federal government activity will continue without pause, at least until November 17th, when we go through this process again. That certainly doesn't mean that the summer was without significant activity from the NLRB. On August 24th, 2023, for example, the NLRB adopted a final rule regarding union representation elections. Representation petitions, for those of you not familiar with it, are filed by employees, unions, and employers who want the NLRB to conduct an election to determine if employees truly want to be represented for purposes of collective bargaining with the employer. The final rule, adopted by the NLRB at the end of August, was an attempt to overturn certain processes and rules that had been in existence, and an attempt to eliminate delays in the election process and make it easier to proceed with unionizing. According to the NLRB, the amendments will significantly reduce the time to go from petition to election in cases where election is contested, as well as expedite the resolution of any post-election litigation. So the new processes, the new procedures, the new timelines, and the new rules are something you should become familiar with if you are about to be or are involved in a representation proceeding. The NLRB also issued an important ruling. If you are keeping track at home, it is In Re Stericycle, which introduced, again, a new current standard to assess whether employers' workplace policies and rules violate the NLRA. And remember, kids, we are not just talking about the NLRA applying to unionized facilities. The NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, also applies to non-unionized employers. So this Stericycle case overrules the prior Trump administration rule, which in turn took the place of prior Democratic-controlled board rules. On this stop of the political merry-go-round comes a rule which now seeks to address what this current board views as overreaching by employers in enacting certain workplace policies and rules in ways that could deter employees from exercising their rights to engage in protected concerted activity under the NLRA. The current board believed that the old standard leaned too much in favor of employers and ignored the economic dependency that employees have on their employers. So the current standard, now adopted in In Re Stericycle by this board, used to evaluate your particular policy with the lens of the NLRA and only the NLRA, is as follows. Does your policy or rule have a reasonable tendency to chill employee rights? If that is demonstrated in the first instance, the employer has the obligation then to demonstrate that the particular policy or rule serves a legitimate and substantial business interest that can't otherwise be accomplished by a more narrowly tailored rule. While not terribly specific or precise and doesn't really offer a whole lot to guide behavior, this will be determined on a case-by-case basis and is very fact-sensitive. Nevertheless, we expect that there will likely be more pro-employee outcomes before this particular board. It is a good opportunity, though, as any time a new rule is adopted, to look at what it is you're trying to accomplish with a particular policy or rule. And can you justify the policy or rule if it's attacked, especially under this new pro-employee standard? Or is this an opportunity to think about, again, what you're trying to accomplish and whether you can implement a policy or rule that is more narrowly tailored with clarifying definitions and provisions that will comport with the NLRB's new standard? Keep in mind that the board in In Re Stericycle also made clear that this new standard applies retroactively to those rules that might have been deemed or considered lawful under the prior standards. Oh, the NLRB. I want to shift to a new concept, that concept being retaliation. And I've talked about retaliation a lot when it comes to things you need to be thinking about beyond the traditional harassment and discrimination concepts and principles that we spend so much time thinking about and trying to avoid in the workplace. Retaliation is often still considered to be the younger sibling of the employment EEO types of cases. But what's interesting is that if you look at the subject of charges filed with the EEOC, retaliation continues to be the biggest subject of the charges filed over the past several years. It's not a particular form of discrimination or harassment, but retaliation. And as we've also talked about, it is often easier to prove retaliation than the underlying allegations of harassment or discrimination. That tends to be the case because, in many respects, there is a temporal argument that is easy to prove. In other words, protected activity took place, followed closely in time by some adverse action alleged to have been retaliatory in nature. A recent decision on September 27th, 2023, from the Southern District of New York involves a very common question asked by employers. Can they assert counterclaims against an employee that has sued the employer? And for those keeping score at home, the case name is Miller versus Levi and Korsinski, and the lesson there is that you need to be careful. You need to be careful when deciding whether to assert counterclaims against an employee or a former employee who has sued for discrimination or harassment. The filing of a lawsuit, says the court in its decision, asserting claims for discrimination does constitute protected activity. That part is probably obvious. The defendants in this particular case clearly had notice of that protected activity because the defendants answered the complaint and asserted counterclaims. The question then became, was the assertion of those counterclaims in the litigation retaliatory, such that it gives rise to a new claim of retaliation for the very employee who sued for discrimination in the first place? And according to the court, the question is whether the assertion of counterclaims was retaliatory based on what the defendants knew at the time they asserted counterclaims, not what may have been adduced during discovery of the ensuing litigation. And according to the court in this case, there was no showing here that the defendants were aware of any of the facts on which they rely to support their counterclaims prior to the assertion of the counterclaims, rather than simply having some mere intuition that the employee violated some policy or some law that gave rise to the counterclaims. In other words, the court here held that these defendants had no factual basis to assert counterclaims at the time they asserted them, and thus the counterclaims were baseless. Once the court made that finding, it then moved on to the second part of this and determined, based on the additional evidence presented, that there was a retaliatory motive to assert the counterclaims deemed by the court to be baseless. Because there was temporal proximity, because there was a lack of a true factual basis to assert the counterclaims at the time they were asserted, and because there was a lack of a legitimate non-retaliatory reason for asserting the counterclaims in the first place. So the takeaways from this decision is to understand the difference between emotion and legality. Often these are very emotional-driven decisions. We're upset that the company is being sued by this employee. We think the employee's claims are baseless. And we want to be affirmative. We want to be aggressive. And we want to assert counterclaims for something like, well, they were a faithless servant, let's try to get their compensation clawed back, or for some other reason. So this decision does not suggest that you can never assert counterclaims in a discrimination or harassment case brought by an individual, but it does suggest that you should step away from the emotional response and analyze the situation. Do you have good faith facts to support the assertion of the counterclaims, as opposed to a judge being able to say you are only surmising that there is a counterclaim to be asserted, and that there is more likely than not a filing of the counterclaims because of or in retaliation for the employee filing the claim in the first place against the company. So it's important to keep these in mind when you are making litigation-related decisions. So I want to end where I started, and that is with the EEOC, and this second development is a real big one. It has to do with the EEOC issuing proposed new guidance on harassment in the workplace. The proposed new guidance was issued and published by the EEOC on September 29th, 2023. And there will be a public comment period of 30 days before the EEOC issues any final guidance. We don't know at this point whether that 30-day period will be extended, but that's what it is at the moment. It's been a long time since the EEOC issued any kind of sub-regulatory documents on the harassment issue. Got to go back to 1999, and before that, 1990 and 1987, when the EEOC was issuing substantive sub-regulatory guidance on issues pertaining to harassment in the workplace. Here you have a new 144-page guidance, though in fairness, 64 of the 144 pages are actually references and footnotes, but I digress. The purpose of the new guidance is to help investigators at the EEOC, as well as stakeholders, employers and employees and their attorneys and representatives, to evaluate whether certain harassment violates federal EEO laws. And here is where I stop again with a footnote: to be mindful of state and local laws on harassment. Because in many cases, New York being one of them, but there are many around the country, there are more liberal standards when you're talking about claims of harassment and discrimination and available defenses for employers. That is also why you see in many states, again like New York, employee attorneys are in many cases not bothering to go to the EEOC as a condition to filing a Title VII lawsuit, not bothering to assert Title VII claims, instead going into state court and asserting only state and local claims, thinking that the standards are more pro-employee than even the federal counterpart. So be mindful not only of the federal standards and defenses, but also of your state and local laws. Back to the EEOC proposed guidance. And again, if you want to see a copy of the 64 pages plus an additional 80 pages of references and footnotes, go to eeoc.gov, or you can email me for a copy of them at mschmidt@cozen.com. In short, the new guidance addresses three questions to evaluate when determining whether there is actionable unlawful harassment. Question one, was the conduct based on a protected class under federal EEO statutes? Question two, did the harassing conduct result in discrimination with respect to terms, conditions, or privileges of employment? And as you know, because I've mentioned it a couple of episodes ago, we are on the precipice of the Supreme Court determining whether to more broadly interpret the term adverse action to make it easier for employees to claim that an adverse action has taken place and therefore making it easier for employees to sue under Title VII. More on that later. Question three for the analysis, is there then, assuming the conduct was based on a protected class, and assuming that the alleged harassing conduct did result in some discrimination with respect to the terms and conditions or privileges of employment, is there a basis for holding the employer liable, the company liable, for the conduct of the alleged harasser? And it is a significant document that the EEOC has released, but I want to drill down a little bit and give you my top 10 highlights from the EEOC's proposed guidance. Highlight number one. The guidance makes clear, quote, although many high-profile harassment cases involve harassment based on sex, race, or national origin, harassment can be as illegal, even if based on other protected classes, end quote. I've said this many times, and it's one of the things I try to highlight in trainings that I do for employers in this area. Most people think about sexual harassment when you talk about harassment, but you can violate Title VII if there is harassment, not just sexual harassment, but harassment based on other protected characteristics. So there can be age harassment, religious harassment, disability harassment, harassment based on genetic information, just by way of example. And the EEOC's proposed guidance gives us examples of potentially unlawful harassment in areas that may be less obvious, like color-based harassment, or that may be newer in its inclusion of Title VII, such as sexual orientation and gender identity. Interestingly enough, though, where the EEOC seems to taketh, it also giveth in a couple of points. Here, the guidance points out that the EEO statutes do not prohibit harassment that is not based on a protected characteristic. That seems to be an obvious statement, but it's interesting that the EEOC went out of its way in its guidance to make that clear. We do hear all the time employees complaining about a hostile work environment from a layman standpoint, not from a term of art standpoint. And while there shouldn't be any workplaces out there that necessarily like the environment to be hostile, somebody who's throwing something, somebody who's cursing, somebody who's screaming, those are not the issues that the EEOC is addressing. The EEOC is addressing, as the EEO statutes are, harassment that is based specifically on protected characteristics. Therefore, causation is an important part of the analysis for that first question I mentioned a moment ago. Was the conduct based on a protected class under federal EEO statutes? In other words, was the conduct that is the subject of the claim or concern actually based on somebody's protected class characteristic? Highlight number two, harassment based on the perception that an individual is part of a protected characteristic is still unlawful even if the perception is wrong. For example, if a company discriminates against an individual who it believes is over 40 years old, but the individual happens to be 38 years old. Or if somebody thinks that the victim comes from Pakistan as a national origin, but in fact the individual does not. Incorrect, inaccurate perception does not mean that harassment based on that perception is not still unlawful. It is. At least under the EEOC's proposed guidance. Highlight number three, intersectional discrimination. It's not a new term, but it is a term that I still think a lot of people out there are not all that familiar with. Intersectional discrimination is sort of what it sounds like. It is discrimination based on the intersection of two or more protected characteristics. It's a growing issue, and the EEOC felt it necessary to address it in their proposed guidance. Again, it is discrimination based on two or more characteristics, protected characteristics, even if no discrimination can be shown toward either characteristic separately or individually. For example, a black woman claims that she was discriminated against because she was a black woman. Maybe there is no evidence that there was discrimination against black employees alone. Maybe there is no evidence that there was discrimination against women alone. But the claim instead is that there is discrimination specifically toward black women. The intersectional discrimination involving race plus gender. Highlight number four. The EEOC's proposed guidance emphasizes again the two primary types of harassment established by the Supreme Court's 1986 decision in Meritor Savings Bank versus Vinson, and later the 1998 decision in Burlington Industries versus Ellerth. That is quid pro quo harassment, probably the simpler one to identify, where adverse action is taken because of protected characteristics. Quid pro quo. You do something for me, I'll do something for you. You don't do something for me, I'll make sure not to do something for you. And the second one is, of course, hostile work environment, as I said a moment ago, hostile being hostile because of a protected characteristic. On the quid pro quo front, the EEOC's proposed guidance talks about how the threat to carry out adverse action may be, in some cases, sufficient even if the threat never was carried out. In certain circumstances, when the threat itself is particularly severe or pervasive enough to alter one's conditions of employment and create an abusive work environment based on the protected class. And the guidance gives examples of some things that might be considered severe and examples of some things that might be considered pervasive. Remember, the standard is not severe and pervasive. The standard is the conduct has to be severe or pervasive. The alleged conduct also has to be considered objectively and subjectively hostile based on, of course, the underlying protected class. It has to be objectively unreasonable, and it has to be subjectively unreasonable or unwelcomed. A lot of litigation on this standard, particularly the subjective part of it. I'll get to that in a moment. But one note, the EEOC's proposed guidance says, quote, these statutes also do not impose a general civility code that covers run-of-the-mill boorish, juvenile, or annoying behavior, end quote. Again, a concept that I think most people knew existed, but now you have the EEOC specifically saying it in its proposed guidance. The EEO statutes are not a general civility code. So there has to be something more than boorish, juvenile, or even annoying behavior. There's been a lot of litigation on that front, and I suspect there will continue to be a lot of litigation even after the new guidance becomes final. Because that sort of sets the standard. You'll know it when you see it. It's not something that can be defined. The EEOC goes a little further to try to help define that and says in its proposed guidance that the standard here is a middle path. A middle path that, quote, requires the conduct to be more than merely offensive, but does not require that the conduct cause psychological harm, end quote. Again, another note worth making here is that an employee who continues to perform well in her or his job does not mean that there is no unlawful, hostile environment created or that the individual welcomed the alleged conduct. And let me pause here because I tend to say this quite a bit as well, particularly in trainings to employers and their groups. Do not get to the point where you are playing psychologist and you are trying to read the minds of the workforce, of the alleged victims, to determine for yourself whether conduct is welcomed or subjectively okay to those individuals. That's not where you want to be. Focus on the conduct. Focus on the behavior that you're trying to prevent. Don't focus on what the reaction is or what you think the reaction should be. And that's where I get to highlight number 5 of the EEOC's proposed guidance, talking about subjective hostility, this notion of unwelcomed. Please don't play psychologist. Focus on what conduct, behavior, and statements should not be made instead of what you think the reaction was or should have been. The EEOC's proposed guidance also makes a few other interesting points. It doesn't matter if other similar groups, similarly situated groups or individuals, would have been or were fine with the alleged conduct. If this individual found it to be subjectively hostile and it was otherwise objectively hostile, that's all that matters. It also doesn't matter if this particular individual tolerated or even participated. The EEOC says that's not dispositive. Left unsaid, I suppose, is that it could be relevant to the analysis, but the EEOC makes it clear that it is not dispositive. And one's subjective reaction to conduct can change over time. There is no waiver here. Simply because an individual did not find conduct to be unwelcomed or subjectively hostile on day one doesn't mean that she or he didn't find it to be unwelcomed or subjectively hostile on day 7 or day 100. Highlight number 6. The EEOC also devotes some of its proposed guidance to how to evaluate timeliness, particularly when you have multiple acts, multiple behaviors that are the subject of the particular claim, where one or more of those acts may be time-barred under the statute of limitations. According to the EEOC, an individual can challenge an entire pattern of conduct as long as you have two things. As long as one, at least one of the incidents is timely. For example, at least one of the incidents is brought within 300 days of that occurrence. And two, the earlier conduct prior to that timely incident has to be sufficiently related to the later conduct to be part of the same actionable hostile work environment claim. So you can rope in earlier untimely claims if you have at least one of those acts that are timely, and if the earlier untimely acts are sufficiently related to be part of the same actionable hostile work environment claim. And the EEOC's proposed guidance gives some examples of that as well. Highlight number 7. The EEOC's proposed guidance makes clear that harassment can affect someone's work environment to be sufficiently unlawful, even if the conduct is not directed at that particular employee. You still need to go through the analysis to make sure that the acts that form the basis of the harassment claim truly were objectively unreasonable and subjectively had an impact to that employee. But the point is that the harassment acts themselves don't have to be directed at the particular employee for that employee to have an unlawful hostile environment claim. Highlight number 8. Other points are made in the proposed guidance that many of us have been talking about in discussions and training already for years. Harassment can exist, the EEOC makes clear again, even if the place that the conduct is occurring is outside the four walls of your typical office, and even if the conduct occurs outside regular work hours. That's more important to keep in mind, given how much we rely on non-in-person communications and how often we engage in work and work-related activities outside a physical work office. The textbook examples are holiday parties and business travel, where, of course, the rules of the road don't cease to apply. The rules of the road when it comes to harassment also don't cease to apply when the conduct or the statements occur through means other than in person. And I always like to say that the conduct occurring in the physical water cooler setting is just as important as the conduct to look at when it's occurring at the physical, at the virtual water cooler. I really screwed that up. Let me say it again. It's not enough that conduct occurred just at a physical water cooler if the unlawful conduct or statements are occurring at the virtual water cooler. The rules of the road to make that conduct or those statements unlawful don't cease to exist. So that can be statements or conduct done virtually, through social media, electronically, on emails or texts. Again, like I said before, don't focus on the reaction to the behavior, focus on the behavior. Here too, don't focus on the location or the means of the conduct or statements, focus on the conduct and the statements when implementing and training on your workplace anti-harassment, anti-discrimination, and anti-retaliation policies. Highlight number 9. The proposed guidance goes through a large and lengthy discussion about how to establish if an employer, if the company, is liable for the unlawful conduct of one of its employees. So let me summarize the steps of analysis for you to take here. And again, I implore you to go back and look at the EEOC guidance itself, because it goes through a real detailed discussion on this topic and gives lots of helpful real-world examples on these points. Step 1. If the alleged harassing conduct results in an explicit change to a term, condition, or privilege of employment, the employer is automatically liable for that conduct. If it's not that type of quid pro quo harassment, but the allegation instead is that a hostile environment harassment took place, then the analysis depends on who the alleged harasser is. And let me go through the 4 points here. Point 1. If the harasser is the proxy or the alter ego of the employer, of the company, the employer is automatically liable with no defenses available under Title VII. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. Say it again. If the harasser is the proxy or the alter ego of the employer is automatically liable with no defenses. Point 2. If the harasser is a supervisor, but not shown to be the proxy or alter ego of the employer, and if there is some tangible adverse employment action that was taken as part of the hostile environment, the employer is automatically liable, again, with no defense under Title VII. Point 3. If the harasser is a supervisor, but not a proxy or alter ego of the employer, and there is no tangible adverse employment action as a result of the hostile environment, the employer is still automatically liable, but the employer has a defense under Title VII to limit liability or damages if the employer can prove, one, that it acted reasonably to prevent and promptly correct harassment, and two, that the employee unreasonably failed to use a complaint procedure or otherwise to avoid or minimize harm, commonly known as the Farragher-Ellerth defense under federal law. I stop here again for my state and local jurisdiction asterisk, and that is because there are states and local governments who have enacted laws that have either limited or totally restricted the ability of an employer to rely on this Farragher-Ellerth defense for liability and or for damages. So make sure you understand the law in your jurisdiction and understand that simply because you may have an ability to raise the defense for federal Title VII purposes, you may not have the same defense when it comes to state and local laws. For those that are able to make that Farragher-Ellerth defense, the EEOC makes clear that the policy and the complaint procedures established by the company can't just be any old policy and procedure on paper. They have to be effective. They have to be effective. Again, probably stating the obvious for many people, but the EEOC says it explicitly. They have to be effective. And the proposed guidance gives examples of what may constitute effective policies and complaint procedures. And the proposed guidance also makes clear that it's not enough to have an effective policy or procedure on paper sitting in a drawer somewhere. You want to, as an employer, make sure that you are implementing those effective policies and that you are training your employees, particularly the managers in the trenches, on those effective policies. Point number 4 of 4. If the alleged harasser is not a proxy, is not an alter ego, and is not even a supervisor, the employer is liable for the alleged harassment only if the employer can be shown to have been negligent by failing to act reasonably to prevent the harassment or to take reasonably corrective action when aware or should have been aware of the conduct. So again, in this last point, where the harasser is not a proxy or alter ego of the employer and is not even the alleged victim's supervisor, we don't have automatic liability for the conduct when a hostile environment claim is being made. Instead, it is a negligence standard, a mere negligence standard, that the employer will be liable if you can show that the employer failed to act reasonably to prevent harassment or to take reasonable corrective action when the employer was aware or should have been aware of the conduct forming the basis of the claim. The EEOC here makes a very important note. Oftentimes, and this happens particularly in litigation of harassment or discrimination claims, where the employer asks a question at some point during the case, maybe during a deposition, well, why didn't you complain about the harassment or the discrimination? And the individual says in many cases, well, I didn't think it would do anything, or I thought I would be retaliated against if I complained. The EEOC devoted some portion of its proposed guidance to this issue and notes that there may be some reasonable explanations for a delay or outright failure to complain about harassment or discrimination, though on the other hand, a generalized statement is not going to be enough, even to the EEOC. So what might be a reasonable explanation for delaying or failing to complain? It could be an employer-created obstacle, like if there's an undue expense to the employee to go through a complaint procedure, or there are inaccessible points of contact, or the procedure is itself intimidating or burdensome. Another possible reasonable explanation is if there is a reasonable belief that complaining would be futile. The belief has to be reasonable. or if there is a reasonable risk of retaliation. Again, it has to be a reasonable risk, not just any perceived risk. And the EEOC specifically says here that, quote, generalized fear of retaliation standing alone will not be considered reasonable, end quote. So an employee doesn't just get to say, well, I didn't complain, or I delayed in complaining because I thought I might be retaliated against. Instead, the employee has to show that there was some reasonable basis for that fear, such as there were other people who complained utilizing that complaint procedure and who were retaliated against. Highlight number 10, the last one in my top 10 list. The EEOC proposed guidance discusses systemic harassment. So it's not just about individualized harassment. In other words, harassment targeted to or impacting a single individual. Systemic harassment is conduct that subjects multiple individuals to a singular form of discrimination or harassment. For example, maybe there's evidence that all black employees on a particular shift were subjected to the same unlawful race-based conduct. That could lead to a claim of systemic harassment, something that you as employers want to be cognizant about. So there's my top 10 highlights from some very significant proposed guidance coming out of the EEOC just this past week. Real significant, both because it's the first time the EEOC has put out such a substantive document in so long, and also because it covers so many different issues that employers are grappling with when it comes to claims of harassment and litigation of claims of harassment. Feel free, as I said, to go on to the EEOC.gov website for a more in-depth review of this proposed guidance. Email me if you want me to send you a copy. I'm happy to do that. We will see what the EEOC does when it comes to implementing a final rule eventually after the public comment period expires. And as always, we will keep you updated on this development. Like with all of the other developments that we discussed on this episode. And that's it for our summer wrap-up as we get into the fall season and the fourth quarter of 2023. I don't profess to say that there will be less employment law developments and trends to talk about, but I can promise that I will be here to discuss them with you and to give you a sense of what those trends and developments are and how they may impact your organizations. Keep the feedback coming. If there's a particular topic that you would love to hear addressed on this podcast, if you have criticism, constructive or otherwise, or something positive to say, please send it my way. I appreciate so much all of you listening to this podcast, whether just as a one-off or regularly over the years. And until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.